Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally. It's good to be back. Episode 1, Season 8. We may not be the original. I believe we're probably the best at the moment, but hey, I'm kind of probably slightly biased by that. But the reason why I think we're the best, because on my right, I have someone like Ryan Champion. Hello, Ryan Champion.
Hello. God, you don't normally come to me first. That shocked me.
Well, it's a new season. I thought I'd mix it up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And on my left, okay. I have the illustrious young protagonist, main man, just everything, all things to all men when it comes to motorsport journalism at the moment. The rising star, that is Jack Bennion. Hello, Jack Bennion.
Hello, Tony Simpson. I'm not surprised that you built up the podcast and then went to Ryan first for a change. That's not convenient, is it, that you decided to do that?
Well, don't be getting precious.
I agree with you, mate. I think Ryan's the best.
We're 15 seconds into this season and already, right, there's been a hissy fit. I can't believe it.
We've got two weeks of pent-up frustration that we've got to get rid of in 20 minutes. So,
do you know what? I've had this experience on podcasts before where people get precious. It really gets hard work. Anyway,
I'm not precious.
No. Perish the thought, boys. It is good to be back. It's been a busy 2 weeks. Of course, we've had Corsica. I've also been doing some other bits and pieces behind the scenes for the podcast. If you've not checked out the new website, folks, please go and check it out. It's absoluterally.co.uk. We're going to try and put some more stuff on there and try and get a little bit more interactive with it. And the people who, by the way, who've been on Patreon, thank you all so much. You've already subscribed and donated a little bit via Patreon. Really, really do appreciate it. And we will be telling you over the next few weeks of hopefully what we're going to be doing with what we're raising via Patreon. Anyway, listen, it's the first episode back. We've had Corsica at the weekend, and of course we have to go to Corsica first, boys. Jack was obviously working very, very hard for Autosport throughout the weekend, monitoring it and everything else. Jack, I know it's you're not there, but you're experiencing every step of the way, really, are you, when you're doing those feeds?
Yeah, you do get quite sort of invested in everything that's going on. And obviously, you know, from a personal point of view, you know, I'm working for Autosport. So for me, it's very important to make sure you don't miss everything and make sure that the coverage is as good as it can be. So, you know, I think you've got a sort of, you know, a personal sort of investment as well in that. But yeah, I found it really exciting. Obviously, a shame to see Chris go out. But apart from that, you know, the battle was good. And yeah, we've got four different winners from four different cars, four different drivers winning for the first four rounds. So you can't really get too upset about that, can you, really?
Not at all. Right, if I can come to you, obviously, you know, Chris, probably better than Jack and I put together. I don't think any of us were surprised that Chris was on the pace, certainly with his driving. I think we were all concerned leading up to this event with what was going on with the Citroen, but apparently they went back to basics and it seems to have kind of reaped some rewards, albeit stakes times wise for both him and Craig. Obviously, you know, the third car wasn't quite on the pace, but Chris certainly was, as was Craig.
Yeah, the car's definitely working now, isn't it? We saw a dominant display in Mexico on gravel, come to Corsica on tarmac, and it was the Citroën we expect to see. You know, a dominant, fast Citroën on French tarmac. What we don't expect to see is an engine problem. That's very un-Citroën-like and really unfortunate, because Chris really did seem to be in control of things. He seemed to be on top of things, driving very, very well. But, unfortunately, unreliability does creep in, and there's a bit of unreliability going around at the weekend. Obviously, M Sport suffered a little bit as well.
Yeah, Jack, as I say, you were monitoring it kind of almost blow by blow, but stage by stage. This hydraulic problem, which seemed to, we don't know whether Tanak would have experienced it. Unfortunately, he didn't have the best of weekends for various reasons, but certainly the two cars that were running seemed to encounter these hydraulic issues.
Yeah, it's a a shame to see some of the cars suffering reliability, but it does happen, doesn't it? Especially with new cars, when you come to new rules, it shakes things up and makes things a bit more exciting. And I think these cars are going so quickly that they're obviously pushing the components to the absolute limit, aren't they? And we saw some problems with the M Sport cars. Not convinced all the issues are exactly the same, but they're all hydraulic based. And we saw OJ specifically in rear wheel drive for parts of a stage on Saturday, and then lacking anti-lag on the Sunday. So some big issues for the world champion, and considering that, I thought he did a pretty good job.
I think from a journalistic point of view, I'll come back to you first, Jack. He was very I'm not too sure that it's diplomatic, but certainly some stage ends he didn't want to get drawn into a conversation with Julian a couple of times what was going on. Julian did try and pull information from him. He wasn't prepared to be to be drawn on too much stuff, but his facial expression kind of said it all, didn't it?
Yeah, I think his attitude said everything, didn't it? You know, he wasn't happy with the fact that his car wasn't performing very well. And, you know, we've seen a Sebastien Ogier with a, you know, I think we can say it now, a relatively bulletproof VW for the past few years. And, you know, now this sort of reliability issues at the start of the year, probably not something that he's, you know, he's coped with very much for the past few years. And, you know, in the year before he had the Polo, he was in the S2000 Skoda, which was pretty reliable that year as well. So something maybe a little bit new to him and a little bit frustrating for him. But, you know, I thought... it was probably a different way of handling it to what most drivers handle the situation when they've got that kind of problem. He just kind of said, you know, I'm not talking about this until the end of the rally, and you know, it's as simple as that. So it is a slightly different way of dealing with it, but at least that way he's not criticised the team unfairly for something that he doesn't know, you know, the root cause of the problem. So you know, a kind of reflective approach of his approach to how he goes about things, I think, for Sebastien. He won't criticise until he knows exactly what the problem is. And I think that's what we saw during Corsica.
Right. Well, that must be, you know, music to the ears of obviously the senior people up at M Sport. Do we sometimes want to hear a driver basically lay it all on the line and have a good whinge, or are we glad that they're keeping it within and you know, almost behind closed doors?
I think we like drivers to be characters, don't we? But then sometimes when a driver gets outspoken, you sort of cringe a little bit, don't you, and feel for the team, because this year they're all working to brand new rules, or they're all working to a new specification of car. It's the first all tarmac rally, and all the teams have had issues, haven't they? You know, nobody's been devoid of issues so far this year, and I'm sure Ogier at the end of the day was very pleased to take a second place rather than a Chris Meek who retired. So he's still doing what Ogier does best and picking up points every rally. So if we call it a bad rally for him, finishing second, he's still had a good weekend, hasn't he?
Boy, it seems very odd, the fact that we've spoke about Chris, we spoke about obviously Sebastien Ogier, but we've yet to speak about the winner, of course. And it was coming, wasn't it, Jack? You know, he was your tip right at the beginning of the season. He was going to dominate, and in many ways he has, but he hasn't quite got it over the line. He managed to get over the line in Corsica.
Yeah, it's been a difficult few rallies for him, hasn't it? And, you know, I think although you can criticise him for the performances he's put in the sense that, you know, he's thrown two rallies away while leading, it shows quite a lot of mental fortitude that he's come back and done well on this one, doesn't it? And I think, you know, probably reflects well for the rest of the year in terms of where he's at mentally and where he's at in the car. Because, you know, even after Sweden and Monte Carlo, it wasn't a heartbroken Thierry Neuville, was it? It wasn't a Thierry Neuville criticising himself or sort of questioning his ability in a rally car. It was, you know, his comment after both was, that was bad luck and we'll be back and fighting for the next one. And, you know, he's got a good podium under his belt in the last round and then come back to this one. And yes, he's benefited from a couple of people having problems, but he's been there at the end of the rally to finish it off and seeing it through, which is obviously a massive positive for him.
Mental fortitude, Ryan.
Yeah,
did you pick up on that? That was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I was there from that point onwards, Jack. I was just in awe of that word. I didn't hear too much of that after that, but good word. I like the fact that you do bowl out that odd word every now and again in these pieces, to be honest with you. Very impressive.
Cool. Very good. Impressive. I'm glad I should be quite good at that, given my job, really.
Yeah, at least one of the three of us is educated.
Yeah, anyway, moving on. No, it's you know, a very, very, very good point. I want to kind of quickly go through some bits and pieces from the rally. I watched, obviously, your feed, Jack, throughout the weekend. Right, were you watching Jack's feed? Were you keeping up to the speed on WRC Plus and things, or how did you watch the rally?
Yeah, a little bit of all of them. You know, stage times on the net. I watched coverage on WRC Plus, a bit of Red Bull TV as well, trying to decide which one I wanted to watch, watching what Jack had to say as well. So, yeah, I kept in touch with it. And, yeah, I was really pleased to see Thierry Neuville get a result. I mean, it was really hard for him to lose those two rallies at the beginning of the year after such dominant performances. And, okay, he had a little bit of luck this time, but I think he was due a little bit of luck. And I think that's great to get him. Get him this win, because I think we'll see a competitive Thierry Neuville for the rest of the year.
This is Absolute Rally. The Supercar and Rally Show blasts into Bangor-on-Dee Racecourse the 17th and 18th of June. On-track action, displays and fun for all the family this Father's Day weekend.
tickets on sale through www.tsars.org. The Supercar and Rally Show, Bangor on Dee Racecourse, 17th and 18th of June. We'll see you there. This is the Absolute Rally Podcast.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. Jack, I'm going to come to Ryan in a second because he tweeted about the Toyotas over the weekend. The fourth for Jari Mäkipää does kind of feel like it's been lost almost. Is it the fact, you know, he just went about his business and he wasn't in with a shout at any point and he just kind of chipped away, and obviously he got past Craig Green, you know, I think it was on the second day, and he just kind of held station and everything else, and clearly the Toyota has still got probably a lot more work to do over the Hyundai and the Fiesta. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, they worked really hard to get the car sorted, and Jari was really not happy with it on Friday. But, you know, sort of a breakthrough change at service on Saturday meant that they were a lot better, and it was a rear diff change that they made really brought the Toyota to life. And he actually gave one of my favourite quotes of the weekend, actually, at the end of the power stage, when he said that was a crazy attack. He pushed it as hard as he possibly could, and I thought it was a good performance from Jari. What we're seeing is a Jari who's not kind of throwing his toys out the pram or getting upset about his car not being quite as good as the other WRC cars. He's chipping away and they're making changes, and they're almost using the rallies as tests, aren't they? And I think, you know, if you look at where they are in the championship now, then I think they would have bit your hand off at the start of the year to be where they are, having won an event and scoring points on all the rallies. So, you know, brilliant. And really, Hannonen showed a lot of pace as well in his car when he wasn't crashing or retiring. So, you know, positives to take for Toyota, definitely. And I'm sure, you know, Tommy's happy with where they're at this point.
I'm 50-50 on that one, Jack. I know Rai tweeted about you and Hannon, and can he keep this pace up? And the next tweet was, no, he can't. which I felt was very cruel, by the way. I felt was very cruel. Would you agree with Jack there, Rai, that Tommy will be happy with the lot at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. And I think to say that, you know, they're further behind in development, I'm not entirely sure. I don't know if they'd have gone to Corsica and expect to set fastest times as they did. You know, I think it was just a case of maybe getting Jari Matti comfortable in the car. And once he was comfortable, wow, the times were incredibly impressive for, you know, like the first proper tarmac rally. And the fact that Hannonen,
was it not everybody's first proper tarmac rally, though, not just Toyota's?
Yeah, it was, but Toyota are still building from scratch, aren't they? Like, at the end of the day, Citroën have an awful lot of experience to call on in terms of diffs, in terms of suspension. Yes, okay, it might be a fundamental change to this year's car, but they still ran cars on tarmac for the last however many years.
I'll have that. Go on, sorry, Mike.
I think, yes, okay, this year's cars are new, but they're still derived from last year's cars. So I think the other teams at least had, you know, some basis to go from. And I think the fact that Toyota was setting incredible times, really, for, you know, okay, Latvala's won on tarmac, Hannonen's won on tarmac, but you wouldn't class them as tarmac specialists, and yet the speed they were setting was very, very impressive.
Go on, Jack, sorry.
I was just going, you know, I was just going to add, you know, I've been quite vague in what I said there, but, you know, in specifically what I'm talking about is Jari Mäkipää is second in the Drivers' Championship points, and Toyota, yes, they're third out of four manufacturers, but they're ahead of Citroën and they're within 40 points of M Sport. So, you know, if you'd have said that with two cars, so if you'd have said that at the start of the year, I think Tommy would have been really happy with that. And I think when you put it like that, it's, you know, I think that's right.
I'd say maybe one and a half cars.
Well, that's where I was going to. I was kind of playing devil's advocate a little bit when I went 50-50 on that, Jack, because I knew Ryan had tweeted something about you, Hannon. I think one thing that has come out from after the rally, obviously everybody was kind of really, really pleased with what went on with Thierry, and he finally got it over the line and everything else. But the rumour mill with regards to Andreas being in another car, and I've even seen a mock-up of a car, by the way, which did make me smile because it had Ola's surname on the back window. They managed to mock up with the wrong co-driver on the back window of one of the mock-ups that I'd seen, which did give me a wry smile. But these rumours don't appear to be going away. And is it just convenient, the fact that Andreas is available? If Andreas wasn't available, would there be realistically any other drivers around, Jack, would Johanan and Seep be under this hypothetical threat that's being spoken about in the press?
I think this probably two elements to this, isn't it? I think Toyota made their bet at the start of the year with Lappi, and you know, we've got a story in MN this week saying that Lappi's going to be in the car for the rest of the European rounds. And perhaps the other element is that, you know, the fact that Mikkelsen came up at a time where Toyota basically confirmed their drivers or were very close to and didn't really have room for him. But you know, he's rocking up at, you know, he's done two rallies so far and he's 10th in the overall points ahead of Juho Hanninen, and having driven an R5 car for two events. So when you put it like that, it's quite cutting towards Juho, isn't it? And you know, I know Juho was ill for one of the events, and you know, he's crashed in the other two. But after being out of the competitive WRC for a while, it's one thing driving a WRC car and testing it, but it's another trying to keep up with Sebastian Ogier, isn't it? So I think there's a few people being a little bit harsh on Juho, but for me, I'd have Andreas in that car tomorrow quite happily.
Right, do you think that's a fair point, what Jack's just said? You know, seat time is all very well and good, but competitive seat time is a completely different kettle of fish to testing.
Yeah, it is, and you know, Hanninen, let's not forget, in IRC days, Hanninen was fantastic on both gravel and tart against Andreas Mikkelsen and against Chris Meek. But we talked about this at the beginning of the year. Hanninen's chances in WRC cars had not gone particularly well for him at that point, and unfortunately, the year's, you know, it's panning out as a difficult year for him so far. I mean, I was really impressed when he, obviously, to crash on the first stage is as big a kick to your confidence as you can possibly have. So to come back on the second day and be bang on the pace again, that's mightily impressive. To then go off the road again is maybe a bit less so. So he's definitely under pressure. You know, if it'd be nice to see him get some results, but it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, one thing I hadn't noticed, I've just been looking at the stage times there, I didn't realise how close it was between Yari Matti and Craig Breen. Genuinely, yeah. Didn't it? Yeah. That was phenomenally close. Wow.
Speaking of Craig, Tony, very quickly, he's the opposite to Juho in the way you look at things, in the sense that he's been out of the WRC as well, not had consistent sort of competitive experience, but the way he's gone about it is by building his pace up slowly, getting quicker every rally, not doing anything stupid, keeping the car on the road, and he's, you know, he's ahead of Chris Meek in the points despite doing one less event in a new car and one in an older car. You know, he's continued to impress in his consistency. So while Juho is in a sense bringing these questions on himself by going off the road and doing things like that, Craig is maybe not the quickest on the stages, and he's definitely not the quickest driver in the WRC, but he's going about it in a more graduated approach, and that's why there's no questions about whether Craig Breen should be in a WRC car this year, but there is questions about why Hugo's in a car this year.
Absolutely. It's interesting, obviously. I'll tell you what, I'll come back to you first, Jack. Obviously, you guys at MN score the drivers, and the Danny Sordo scoring that David Evans did give me a wry smile, and it comes about over the fact that effectively he lost second place on the power stage.
Yeah, it's really difficult to try and judge where Danny's at, and you know, to a certain extent, I disagree with David, and to a certain extent, I agree with him, in the sense that anyone who's finished on a podium in a WRC rally has done a good job. But when you look at, as David quite rightly points out, when you look at Thierry Neuville, who won the rally, and Danny's supposed to be the tarmac specialist of the team, that actually looks like a fairly poor result for Danny, doesn't it? And, you know, I think Chris would have been a little bit, you know, if Chris had stayed in the rally and had kept up the pace he was at, he would have been a bit further ahead of Thierry as well. And, you know, Danny wouldn't have been on the podium. So, yeah, for me, that wasn't a great performance from Danny.
You know, that's a really, really interesting point. And again, it's fantasy land again. And I'll ask you first, Brian, and I'll come to you, Jack. The way Thierry kind of built and built and built and got quicker as the weekend went on, and okay, Chris wasn't there. Do you think he would have caught Chris? Right? Do you think it would have been a lot closer than perhaps, you know, the rally's finished? You know, 54-second, you know, advantage he had at the end. Do you think perhaps between Chris and Thierry, do you think it realistically he could have caught Chris?
Difficult to say, isn't it? But he was getting quicker, as you say. But then I'm sure, as Chris, you know, got even more confident going through the event as he was setting the times, as he was getting comfortable in the car. You know, I'd like to think Chris could respond, but it would have been a good battle. It would have been interesting to see. And I think, yeah, the result would have probably been closer than what it ended up being.
Interesting. How about you, Jack? Would you go with that? I'm really, really undecided, to be honest with you, because I kind of feel like Thierry perhaps changed something. And this was the other thing that I noticed on a lot of the stage ends. A lot of the drivers were constantly changing the car. I think Ogier said he never changed the car so much throughout a rally as well. And I think Thierry had changed a few different bits and pieces as well from the first day. Do you think it would have been a lot closer? Do you think he could have caught Chris? Or do you think Chris could have carried on that pace he was going at?
No, I don't think Chris would have been caught for the simple reason that Thierry was quick on Saturday morning, but the gap was 17 seconds, and while that doesn't seem a lot in Corsica, I think Thierry would have had to work very hard to have caught Chris, bearing in mind the speed that he'd shown before. I'd take your point that Nerva was getting quicker, and the roads on Saturday definitely suited him better with the loose sort of sections. He really enjoys tarmac with a little bit of loose on the top, and seems to excel when the conditions are a little bit mixed. And, you know, we saw that in his speed on Saturday morning. But yeah, for me, Chris had that in hand, and it was clear to see when he got to the end of, I think it was stage five, the one before he retired, that they told him what Thierry's time was, and Chris had lost 8 seconds or 9 seconds, and Chris had kind of just nodded his head and gone, yeah, that's fine, nothing to worry about. And he seemed like he was in total control, whether that was mind games or trying to be a bit sort of, you know, trying to look unworried for the TV cameras is a different story. But for me, I felt like Chris had that sort of in hand.
I, you know what, and I may be off on this, I don't know about you, right, I don't think that's how Chris's program, that kind of the mind game. I think he's just, he is who he is, isn't he?
I don't really think he plays mind games. He's very straight up and down, but at the end of the day, whenever somebody takes time off you, whenever it's you're 8 seconds down, then it has an effect one way or another. And yeah, maybe like Jack said, maybe he didn't push as hard in there. He dropped a bit of time, and that's why I thought, yeah, I can cope with that. But I think it still hurts when you see somebody take a chunk of time.
But I want to tidy up on the other categories. Obviously, for the people listening to the podcast, we all know obviously how the rally finished and everything else. We've already mentioned them. A dominant win, dare I say. I'm really cautious about WRC2 when I mention it to Jack these days. a dominant win for Andreas.
Yeah, absolutely. You can rest. You can breathe. Take a breath, Tony. Yeah, he had Timo Sunninen within him, you know, sort of kept him at a minute's gap for the whole event, pretty much. There was a minute where Eric Camelli looked quite quick on Friday, but he seemed to clip a wall and then kind of ruin his chances and fell out of contention after that. So Timo Sunninen, the Finnish M Sport driver, was the second sort of protagonist, but well within arm's reach for Andreas, and any time team to take any time, Andreas pulled it back. But you know, the really interesting one for me that just quickly was Stefan Sarrazin, who didn't register for WRC2, but you know, would have been very, 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 very close to taking second, I think, in his first event with his new team and with the Skoda Fabia R5 that he's not driven before. So it'd be only interesting to see if he
only five time. Seconds off the pace, only 5 seconds off Sunninen. Right. Stefan Sarrazin has been around. You know, he's done GT racing, I think. Are we allowed to mention that? Not sure. He's done various bits of racing. He did quite a bit with Pro Drive, I seem to remember as well, back in the day as well. And he still seems to, he's one of those drivers who just seems to have it, doesn't he? Especially on tarmac events.
Yeah, he's a class act. He was brought in as a tarmac specialist, like you said, in the factory Subaru team. And, you know, just so Jack can tick his box, you know, Sarrazin's a current World Endurance Championship driver, tick your box, Jack. He really is a class act. But having said that, to pitch up at an event like Corsica when you haven't been rallying regularly and to be on the R5 pace is pretty impressive. So, definitely a great job by him. Just mentioning Camilli, I was actually hoping this was going to be an event that we were going to see like Jack did. I mean, I saw Camilli's early times and I thought, oh, this is going to be good. He's going to be on Mikkelsen's pace. There's going to be a battle here. And, you know, it'd be nice to see Camilli actually go from the start to the finish of a rally and get a result, but it wasn't to be.
Well, there you go. I just want to do a little bit of tidying up on a few other bits and pieces. Story that you guys have run, Jack, with regards to the concerns with regards to the stage speed fears. Bosses head off WRC stage speed fears. This is, of course, the average speed thing which came in, and obviously we were a little bit concerned, or certainly the FIA were concerned about maybe having to put chicanes in and things on Finland, but they seem to have found a solution of some sort anyway.
Yeah, bit of a clarification, I suppose. Probably the simplest way to put it was there was a story that came out not so long ago that said the FIA were going to basically intervene with any stage that went over 80 miles an hour average speed for the stage. What the clarification's actually been is that's the speed that it'll take for the FIA to look at the stage. So they may not cancel that stage if it goes 80 miles an hour, but they've set that as their point where if a stage is going to go over that or it's predicted to go over that, then they will take a look at it and decide whether it's safe for it to go ahead. So a bit of a clarification, and they've obviously been talking with teams and drivers who I think this is a topic we've covered quite extensively on Absolute Rally, isn't it, and we were all quite sort of passionate about stages being cancelled and stuff like that. So I'm not going to go too much into that, but yeah, it's just a clarification on that previous point.
Fantastic. Boys, we're going to take a break and then we're going to come back with any other business. But in between that, by the way, I have been doing some work in our 2 weeks off, and you will hear the introduction. And again, it's a gentleman called Jerry Freeman who Ryan will remember well from way back when. But Jerry Freeman was a tyre engineer for Pirelli, and he tested with pretty much every single top line driver, sat alongside them throughout the mid-90s, and he has got some tales throughout this particular piece that we did with him, and it's going to go out. Unfortunately, I set it up to do 20 minutes with him, and it turned into an hour. So I'm going to break it down into little sections. And the first section is basically how he got involved with the sport. His brother, who very sadly passed away, he was alongside Mark Lovell when they had that tragic accident over in the States. Roger Freeman, and we talk about a few bits and pieces there, and drivers and stuff like that. And genuinely, it was really weird because Rai came up in the conversation as well, because it was a very similar thing of when we had Chris Burbeck on with Rai, is that I've known Jerry pretty much all my life, and so to kind of talk to somebody like that, and you don't realise some of the things that they've done. But Jack, from somebody that's a bit of an anorak from kind of mid-90s kind of rallying, you're going to love it. You are going to love it, because there's a Kenneth Erickson story which is just fantastic.
And look, I can't remember what, listening.
Yeah, there you go. So, folks, sit back, relax. We're going to have a little break, and then we're going to come back after Jerry, all three of us, with any other business.
This is Absolute Rally, Pace Notes Rally Magazine, Britain and Ireland's only dedicated rally publication. Rally news, interviews, features and reports from Clubman rallies to the WRC. Available from all good news agents or subscribe at rallymag.com. Pace Notes Rally Magazine, your number one monthly rally read. This is the Absolute Rally Podcast.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. It's always weird when we do these programs, because Ryan and I have spoke about this in the past when we've had the likes of Chris Burbeck on and people like that. It's weird when you know someone and you want to talk to them because you know the background in rallying, you know the people who listen to the podcast would find loads of it fascinating. So this is one I've kind of kept to one side for ages. So for the first time, and hopefully not the last time, welcome to Absolute Rally, Jerry.
Thanks a lot.
Jerry Freeman. Now, what I find fascinating about talking to you about stuff is that there's loads of people who know you for kind of being tyres, and they've seen you on events and stuff like that, but they don't really understand what's gone before and where all this has come from and everything else. So I think it's fair to say these days it is just purely tyres, but you had a massive kind of competition background as well before all this happened, and you know, we know you from Pirelli and stuff like that. How did you get into rallying?
Well, that's a big one. My first rally ever was, technically speaking, they used to call me the Can Lad when I was about 14, maybe, which meant that I used to just clean the windscreens and stuff like that. It was the night rally, Rally of the Lakes, heaven only knows when. But that was with Roger was co-driving for a friend of ours called Richard Stamp, if my memory serves, in a ex Terry Kirby Dolomite Sprint.
Wow. Well, Terry's been on the show and he's talked about the Dolomite Sprint, so it all comes back around once
I'm
again.
I'm sure that Terry never said anything good but great in a straight line, didn't go around corners too easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, you just mentioned your kid there. Of course. Yeah. Was that where the influence came from for the co-driving side? Or?
Probably.
I realise how northern we are. We have listeners all over the world, and our kid might not seem like that. Might sound really confusing for people. So I'm going to clear this up. We're talking about Jerry's brother, Roger Freeman, of course, the late great co-driver. And we, in the north of England, our kid is your brother.
Absolutely.
So we just need to possibly clear that up at this point for everybody in other parts of the world.
No, well, me dad was very much into mechanicking. He'd been, he'd worked with cars all his life, and for one spell of his life, unfortunately, had to work with Lancaster Bombers.
Wow.
And so he was very technical. He was an engineer. And so when nothing got bought, everything got fixed. And it was always, you know, if my dad was fixing the car, then me and Roger would help. You have to remember, Roger was 9 years older than me, so probably Roger helped and I just got in the way. But, you know, there were always cars being done up or played with when we were kids. I remember Roger putting he had a Mini. No one's with a button start in the floor. And he put a Hillman Imp engine in this thing. And he shot off up the road. He came in, told my mother to get in the car. I don't know if it was ballast or he just wanted to frighten her. But he forgot, obviously, to fasten the seats in. So he set off like a bat out of hell up over the road. And all you could see was Roger laughing and my mother's feet in the air. You know, so not, where we came from was that kind of background. And yeah, Roger was a solicitor and had a job in Chester. And Chester, I suppose, along with Newtown in Wales. Newtown in Wales was where every rally started. And Chester was probably where they had the biggest motor club. I mean, in my mind, whether that's true or not, I've no idea. But he kind of fell in with a lot of people. And this bloke that he knew from round the corner, his new mate, Richard Stamp, wanted to go and do some night rallies. So Roger had a go at navigating for that. I just went watching and obviously got the bug from there.
So you were then can lad, and then so when the first event actually comes about, you're 14 can lad. Where does the first event and where does the kind of the rally bug first get you?
For my birthday, which would have been probably 2 years later when I was 16, Richard and Roger didn't tell me, of course, but we spent 2 nights preparing this Dolomite Sprint because they were going to go and do a single venue at, what's the big park in
Tatton?
Stoke.
Is it Tatton Park, is it?
No, used to use it on the RAC all the time.
Oh, I know the one. I can't think of its name now.
I'll think in a minute.
Yeah.
But anyway, there, Trentham Gardens.
Trentham Gardens, there you go.
And there was a single venue at Trentham Gardens. And of course, you know, Stamp hadn't done anything to this car and we had to get it ready and it was in primer and all sorts of things. But anyway, on the morning of the event, the car still wasn't ready, so we had to knock it on the head. And we sat down and these two said, well, actually, that was your debut as co-driver. So they were actually trying to do it for my 16th birthday. They got me a license and all this kind of stuff. So that was where it started. Well, it was supposed to start, but never actually did, you know. So after that, you know, through friends and acquaintances, you know, started going doing a few events here and there and kind of went from there, really. But Roger got far too good too quickly. And he started with people like Terry Pankhurst, who was Terry Pankhurst. I mean, still is just stuff at Alton Park. I see Terry every now and then. Unbelievably quick. Great driver. And Roger did, you know, was it called the Castrol Championship? And
sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, and they won Group N. And then we went at the end of that year to the RAC Rally, which was based in Chester. And they won Group 1 Nezu in his escort.
There's a term, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the same year Ari won in the Rothmans escort. And we went head-to-head for the whole rally with Austin McGill.
Wow.
That's, you know, those were when rallies were dangerous. When you used to get up at the morning on Sunday morning for the RAC, not go to bed till Monday night, have 4 or 5 hours kip, and then not, you know, no more kip until Wednesday night. Wild days, but really good. Yeah, so that was kind of my first introduction properly. I'm doing it at a decent level, and I thought when I saw this, I thought I'm going to have a go at this.
Is this how kind of the work side came about? Is that the working in motorsport? Because a lot of people do that, don't they? Once they kind of get involved with it and they think, okay, this is my passion and everything else, and they try and link it in, obviously. Was that how you ended up working in the tyre industry? Is that
no, I mean, how I got into the tyre industry was, well, yeah, partially linked. Roger obviously went to drive with Ford. I got some kind of jobs alongside him working with Ford, especially doing British Championship. And I actually did the decent thing and went to university, you know. And I was probably the saddest bloke in the world. You know, most people had pictures of Debbie Harry on the wall. I had a picture of Walter Roll. I mean, how sad's that, you know. And yeah, so I went to university and became a teacher. Gradually did a lot more and more and more professional stuff, especially with Ford. And when Roger changed and was with Mark Lovell, and they were doing the British Championship in the RS200, they were obviously very close to Pirelli. I met the people from Pirelli. And after I'd been teaching, I don't know, 3 years, 3.5 years, Pirelli UK Supremo, Andy Hallam, said to me one day, listen, Jerry, do you want to come and work for us doing kind of coordination of Pirelli Motorsport? And like my granddad told me, I said, how much? And when he told me, I said, I'll think about it, yes. So that was it. So I moved from Wigan to Burton-on-Trent and went working as coordinator for Pirelli Motorsport in the UK. But it was fairly obvious, fairly quickly, that because I had experience with co-driving and sort of a lot of experience beyond just organising where to send tyres, that I went on a couple of events with Pirelli in Italy. And I think they decided that I could be more useful there. So I went to Pirelli, Italy.
I still find it amazing, by the way, with your... I know I've got a strong Northern accent. The fact that you've got such a strong Wigan accent and yet are still fluent in Italian, I find that mind-blowing when you've been out at restaurants. I don't think there's anybody else in the world that speaks Italian with a Wigan twang.
Oh, I don't know. We have to remember that the factory was in Milan, so I'm not sure they spoke much Italian anyway. You know, it's... You think it's Italian until you go somewhere like Florence or Rome, where they speak, you know, well, it's not the Queen's, is it, you know, but they speak very, very beautiful Italian, and you realise that actually what you're speaking is probably, I don't know, something, but it's probably not Italian. But at least all the boys understood.
Yeah.
And they used to laugh at me a lot, because I don't actually think that I'm particularly good, and never was, and certainly since I've not been working with Pirelli, and I don't use it every day. I could probably order a beer these days. That's about it.
So that took you obviously over to Italy. Is that where the adventures into the World Rally Championship began? Is that where it all started to happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, you would say that. I mean, obviously, I'd done some World Championship events before.
Because of course you co-drove on international rallies as well. Yeah. Is this before you'd done the likes of Asia Pacific and stuff? Or
this was before Asia Pacific and these kind of things. Yeah, but when I went to when I went working for Milan, I think that probably I did 10 or 12 years or something just doing pretty much World Rally Championship and, you know, Asian Pacific as well, and one or two other things. And it shouldn't be forgotten here, and I obviously got to get this in. When I left Pirelli in the UK, I went to work for Pirelli in Milan. There was a bloke took my job. What was his name? Dick Cormack. That was it. He was my understudy. He'll love that if he is it. So I think that's when I started doing pretty much constantly doing World Championship. And for the first 5 years, it was just amazing.
I swear, because you think about then, that's when, you know, we think now Michelin, obviously, and it's Michelin, DMAC and WRC. But back then, Pirelli was, it was only really the French teams that flirted with Michelin. You know, Pirelli was the tyre that kind of, you think about the Toyotas, you think about, you know, certainly the GT4s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Ford were running the Pirellis then as well, as were, of course, Subaru.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, it was a really big job. I mean, with two or three teams, and bear in mind, not like now where you have, you know, a little bit of a tyre zone where you're allowed to pick, half a dozen tyres or something. I mean, then we would take with us 400 tyres plus every day, absolutely every day. So the boys used to refit everything. And what the boys really liked, the fitting boys, was when their engineer came up and said, we're not having those tomorrow, we'll have something else. You know? So they have to refit 400 overnight. So it really was a big job. Humongously expensive. I mean, I hate to think what the budgets must have been, relatively speaking. But, you know, yeah, we used to, you know, 400 different tyres every day. And actually, to take that from, we'll go and do a test, these are the tyres that we've got, this is our three-car team, and to give them enough choices for every stage of every day, wow, it was a big job. A lot of shipping.
Yeah. I was born 10 years too late. What can I say? 10 years too late. But off the back of that, you must have got to work with drivers, I suppose, that we all kind of not only aspire to, but you know, you talk about having posters of Walter Roller. I reckon probably around 95% of the people listening to this podcast will have posters on the wall of drivers that you've worked with and sat with.
Probably. I mean, obviously it takes a year to get into any kind of job. But once I settled into this job, it became a kind of tripartite job. I used to work with two engineers. I mean, there was lots of other people involved. But there was two other people involved. There was Fiorenzo Brivio, who now works with DMAC, and our other mate, Gianfranco Martelli, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. And the three of us were all very much the same age, and, you know, we used to get on fantastically well. But Gianfranco was gifted at drawing things and actually putting together, if you like, the drawings of how we would want to build a tyre. I was great at ideas. I was so calm. And every time anything went wrong, he'd just kind of sit back and laugh. Fiore, who is just the best tyre engineer I've ever met. Ideas were just brilliant.
Does that come from drivers coming in? Because this is something, again, if you pardon the pun, there's a black art to this.
Yeah, there is.
Where a driver will come in, you can have the best drivers in the world, and I think we do in rallying. And those they can do is give feedback of what they want or what the tyre is not doing. And then you've got, you know, these guys that you're describing here that can go away and effectively design and build a tyre based on what they're being told by his driver.
Yeah, that is pretty much the truth. But the third part of all of this is I used to just go and do all the testing. So I used to sit in the car with them. You know, I hate to think maybe 100, 150 days a year. I used to just sit in rally cars next to the world, what do you say, the world's best drivers.
Yeah.
Not what I used to call them most of the time. But, and so you get the feedback from them. But the difficult part of my job was probably 10% tyre technology and 90% driver psychology, because you had to understand what they said and you had to be able to feel it for yourself, you know. And once you could do that, then you became useful.
Is that where, I suppose, because I don't know about, Gianfranco and the other guy, they didn't come from a competing background, I'm guessing.
No, they didn't.
Is that where...
Oh, they came from a Pirelli background.
Yeah. So you coming in from sitting with people,
yeah,
I suppose, like, you know, during the Boreham days when you were with Ford, you know, the likes of Mark Lovell, probably people like Malcolm Wilson and people like that, you absolutely probably sat alongside.
There's never Boreham sitting next to Malcolm.
Probably still isn't.
It'd be sure it's not.
He's out on the Pirelli rally. He's entered the Pirelli rally. That'll be quite good fun. But I suppose sitting alongside those guys and then being able to, I suppose, learn your trade at that level, and then you come to the World Rally Championship, I suppose.
I think that's probably one of the reasons that, you know, they took me from the UK into Pirelli Milan, was because, you know, I had that kind of experience, and it just seemed to work really, really well. When you actually take a full, I mean, people don't understand what it was like. I'm sure it's exactly the same now. I'm beginning to sound like my dad. You know, oh, I remember. But no, maybe people don't quite understand what was, and I'm sure still is, involved. For example, let's go to Australia. Australia is such a good rally, but you had to be so precise in Australia because the roads were defined by trees. So you couldn't afford to have tyres that weren't precise and good. So how do we go about doing Australia rally? Well, the first thing you do is you take the tyre that you used as your base tyre the year before. So Australia used to be about October, something like that. So just kind of in the spring. So we would go and test normally about June. So they would send to Australia a load of tyres that were just the base tyre from the year before, send them down in a container for the test. Then we would kind of have a big sit round and decide what we were going to send. So you'd sit there and Fiore would say, and Gianfranco would say, well, this is the developments that we've made so far this year. We know that this works, so what we'll do is we'll make some test tyres like this. But if you remember what Australia was like last year, and we said this, because we've all written reports, we've all got lots of notes, but this is what we said we ought to do for the next year, blah, blah, blah. And so what you would get on the back of that is maybe 12 test tyres, which would be normally 4 new constructions or changes of construction, 4 changes of compound, and 4 brilliant ideas that turned out, you know, normally not to be that brilliant, but, you know, every now and then you really got a great one. So you then go to Australia, do a test, so you would have 4 or 5 days just playing with the car, because that's exactly what any manufacturer does. You know, they need a baseline to work from, so they've got the same tyre they had last year. They would do all the developments with the suspension and the geometry and all the car, blah, blah, blah. Get it set up, get the car so that they know they've made an improvement. And then what we would do is we would do a tyre test. And tyre tests are not really that simple. You don't just put it on and go for it. There's a certain amount of logic involved, which means that, I mean, it's just quite obvious. If you change more than one thing between tests, you don't actually know what's changed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you actually stiffen the suspension and change the tyre and the result is it's 2 seconds faster, which is to blame? You know, and you've got no idea. So you have to be very logical about what you did. So, you know, you would start with a base tyre, change the tyres gradually, so you're only ever changing one thing at a time, come back to where you were originally at the base tyre and see if you've improved. And if you've improved, and then you can re-prove, do it again and show that it was faster and it was better, then you go to a different road and you do it all over again.
Isn't there always a danger of when you get a driver doing a tyre test like that, that they're just getting sharper and sharper throughout that test as opposed to...
Absolutely.
How do you stop that? How do you manage that?
What you were doing, I said at the beginning, you use your base tyre. So you've got our tyre from last year, whatever it was. You would put that at the beginning. Then you gradually go through, let's say, construction 1, construction 2, construction 3, back to a base tyre. Because then what you're doing is you can draw a graph of that. So if you did 2 minutes and 2 seconds the first time and 2 minutes the second time and draw a line between that, then you can look at the tyres that you have just tested and see whether they are below the line or above the line and tell you if it's faster or not. So basically, and then you do the test again. And it will gradually go, there's no doubt it does go faster and faster, but you also have to use a bit of common sense as well, because if you're sitting next to the guy, you can tell if he's getting carried away.
Can we do a roll call of the people who you sat alongside you on that period?
I never sat alongside Hannu Mikkola, which was a great regret, or Walter Rove.
Okay.
Pretty much everybody else.
So that's just for the sake of, I suppose, unfortunately, I was just about to say Tommy, but Tommy, of course, was a Michelin runner.
Yeah, but Tommy, remember, went with the Nissans.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've known Tommy a long time. Tommy, one of the nicest blokes I know. And Tommy, we did a test in Sweden with a Nissan. And that was really quite entertaining. Really quite entertaining. the use of snowbanks. I didn't realise that quite happened.
I can imagine that cow shit out when you're not expecting it.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
It was absolutely fun.
So we go Tommy Mackinnon, Carlos Sainz.
Yeah.
McRae.
Or both of them.
Both of them. And whether you're going to have the hat trick, all three.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good.
Yeah.
Actually, Jimmy earlier on in my career, I would have said.
Yeah.
A lot earlier. So, yeah, probably all three.
Yeah, there you go. Richard Burns.
Yeah, co-driver four.
Of course, you did now.
And Alistair.
Now, this is where we slightly go left field again here. I'd forgot genuinely that until I reread Richard Burns' book that you went over and was it Ypres or something like that? You sat there inside, Richard?
We did a rally in Belgium. I mean, it was just to sort of further his knowledge because he was obviously gifted. Now, he was obviously gifted. And I knew him and I knew some of his management team. And so I just went with him to sort of increase his experience, and especially abroad. But yeah, all good fun.
Yeah. So an event with Richard.
I don't remember what the event was, to be honest.
I seem to remember it. I think
it was Holland.
Was it Holland or Bel? I had it in my head it was something like Ypres or something like that.
No, it wasn't Ypres. No,
okay.
No.
So you did an event with Alistair as well?
Yeah, I did a couple with Alistair. I did Rally of Indonesia, and I think we finished second.
Yeah.
And we did a couple of rallies in Scotland and won.
Yeah.
But, you know, adventure. Anything that's got a McRae in it just ended up as an adventure rather than a rally. Yeah.
So I'm just kind of going through your names, kind of Kenneth Eriksson, but I suppose.
Kenneth, absolutely.
Yeah.
Another one, fantastic, fantastic blog. I'll tell you a story about Kenneth Eriksson. That's one of the funniest things I ever saw in my entire life because, you know, Kenneth Eriksson can speak to animals. Did you know that?
I did not know that kind of
thing. Kenneth Eriksson can speak to animals. We were in New Zealand. This is absolutely true. There are several stories about Kenneth Eriksson and animals, but this one.
Are these all ones that are okay for broadcast?
That's what, oh, yeah. I mean, anything to do with Kenneth is okay for broadcast. What a great bloke. But Kenneth told everybody he could speak to animals. We were on the top of this hill in New Zealand early morning, and we were setting up in a kind of, I think it was like a farmyard, really. And we were setting everything up, and the young couple who owned the farm came out, and they got a little dog. And it was a lovely little thing, but it was shaking. So Kenneth said, don't worry, I can speak to animals, and picked this little dog up, and it was shaking. And Kenneth walked all the way around the farmyard, cuddling this little dog and stroking it. And by the time he came back 5 minutes later, and you could hear him talking to this dog. He came back 5 minutes later and it was still shaking. I said, what's wrong, Ken? He said, doesn't understand Swedish.
This is the Absolute Rally Podcast. The Supercar and Rally Show blasts into Bangor-on-Dee Racecourse the 17th and 18th of June. On-track action, displays and fun for all the family this Father's Day weekend. Tickets on sale through www.tsars.org. The Supercar and Rally Show, Bangor-on-Dee Racecourse, 17th and 18th of June. We'll see you there.
Pace Notes Rally Magazine, Britain and Ireland's only dedicated rally publication. Rally news, interviews, features and reports from Clubman rallies to the WRC. Available from all good newsagents or subscribe at rallymag.com. Pace Notes Rally Magazine, your number one monthly rally read.
This is Absolute Rally.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. It is good to be back. By the way, I hope you've checked out some of our new advertisers as well. Obviously, we've got Pace Notes and we've got the Supercar and Rally Show, which is going to be coming up. So please check out the website. Have a look for those guys, what Bryn Mawr's trying to do there. And if you can get involved, come along. And we may even bring our car. We're still trying to work on a deal for that anyway. But anyway, listen, we've got to the end of the podcast and we decided to move any other business to the end of the podcast this week. Just for this week anyway. Might do it next week. We'll see anyway. Who wants to go first, Jack or Ryan?
I'll allow Jack. Go on, Jack.
I know what Jack's is going to be, but Jack, the floor is yours, my friend. You're any other business for this week.
Okay. Very quickly, I just wanted to tidy up some bits from Corsica that I thought were worth mentioning. So Neil Solans won the first round of the Junior World Rally Championship, which got underway with it for the first time with M Sport Fiesta R2Ts. It was Citroen DS3s last year, so a bit of a change there. Our, you know, British junior rally champion Rob Duggan was out there as well, and unfortunately had a bit of an accident, but we won't talk too much about that. WRC3 was won by Raphael Astier, who was a couple of minutes ahead of Neil Solans, but too old for the junior category, so he didn't feature in that. And the RGT Cup made a welcome comeback to the WRC, and Roman Dumas won that one. He also won Monte Carlo as well, so that's two wins for him. So I just wanted to clear them up. And can you guess what my other one was going to be, Tony?
I would say, I could say we're going to clash on this one.
Okay.
Because
what do you think mine's going to be?
I think your any other business is going to be on closed road rallying or closed road motorsports in the UK.
Do you really?
Yeah.
It's not.
Oh. Dude, I was prepared for it. I was prepared for it. Okay, go on. Any other business then.
I thought you two maybe would cover it off, and I've talked enough about it over the past week, so I thought I'd give it a rest.
We haven't been here for 2 weeks, so.
I know, but you know, I've done stuff in MN and Autosport and online, and I'm just.
Yeah, but you've got to remember, Jack. We have people all over the world that listen to us.
Well, I can always write a piece for the Absolute Rally website, can't I?
Do you know what? What a great idea that is. Jack, you're going to write a piece for the Absolute Rally website. There you go. Folks, check it out. And even if you are overseas, you perhaps get an idea and a flavour of what's gone on and why we're trying to get closed road events over here in the UK. I have my opinions on why I think this is the cart before the horse, but still, we'll let Jack write his piece and then we'll discuss it. I think that'll be quite good.
I thought you were going to do it part of your any other business.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to do it. Cool. I've got my other business. It's in my back pocket. It's safe. I know where it is. In the words of Bullseye, your prizes are safe. That's it. They're over there.
I'll run through my other bit very, very quickly. For those who kept an eye on the Pirelli Carlisle Rally last year, which is going to be the Pirelli International Rally this year, we'll have seen quite a bit going on with Bogeygate, as I like to call it, which was a situation where we had people breaking the average speed over a stage, much like we saw, you know, the issue we've seen in the WRC with taking average speed into account. But in the UK, if you beat a certain speed, which is 70 miles an hour on gravel, then you get a notional time. So no matter how much quicker you went than the other person, it doesn't matter because you get given a notional time. So I was quite flat out to the Pirelli organisers last year on criticising them for not taking the information they had at hand before the event, which clearly pointed to the fact that the bogey times are going to be beaten. They didn't ignore it, but they maybe didn't sort of consider it as strongly as they should have and didn't quite make the right changes to fix it. So in the sense of being flat out on them last year, I've gone the opposite way and flat out credited them this year for the work that they've been doing to make sure this doesn't happen again. So they've been working with Brian Patterson, who's well known in the UK for creating Pace Notes, and his Jemba system. There's an explanation all about that in MN if you want to read about what the Jemba system is, but it basically can predict very accurately what the average speed will be for a stage. So congratulations, hopefully, to the Pirelli organisers. I don't want to the chicken to hatch before the egg, or however you say that phrase, but
you didn't think that one through, did you, Jack?
No, I didn't. But
no.
Whatever that phrase is, where
the cart before the horse, maybe.
Yeah,
something
about an egg and a chicken and a horse and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, very much looking forward to going.
That's a different video, that one.
Actually, oh, wow. Be careful when you Google that one.
It's gone to a dark place. It's gone to a dark place.
You know what? There's an even darker place where there's a story about a late. No, I won't go there.
No,
but I read
no,
the story.
Let's not do that. Congratulations, hopefully, to Brian Kinghorn and all his team. Jonathan Lord as well at the Pirelli Rally, and hopefully everything's okay there, and they seem to be happy that they've got a good sort of gap for average speeds on stages. So thanks very much for sorting that out so I don't have to criticise them again.
Well done. It involved a St. Bernard dog called Oscar. That's all I'm going to say. Right, have you done your any other business for this week?
I have, but I'm not sure I can follow that.
You're not sure you can follow the Pirelli International Rally or the...
No, the dog called Oscar.
The dog called Oscar.
Yeah, mine was just a link to Corsica this year. A vague link, I guess, to Corsica. You know, I like to go back in time and look at things how they used to be, and lots of old rally videos, spectacular footage from the past. And have you ever watched A Place in the Sun, Tony? You know, where a family go off and buy like a nice house in the Algarve.
Do you know what? Right, I have a guilty pleasure of watching programs like that. It is a kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. So yeah, I'm very familiar with that program.
You just like the presenter, don't you?
Moving on.
Anyway, this isn't about a family going off and buying a house in Corsica, you know, a place in the sun.
So that really didn't matter, did it, that bit? That was superfluous for the story.
No, it isn't because there was an old Castrol, I think it was Castrol video of the 1983 Corsica, Rally of Corsica, called A Place in the Sun. And it covered the 1983 version of the rally, and it was an epic rally that year. It was obviously when the Audi and Lancia battle was at its height. Audi had come in with these brand new tarmac cars, which didn't work on tarmac. Lancia dominated, with it was like the top four places, and Tony Pond had a heroic effort in a sideways Nissan 240 RS. And it's all covered in this old footage called A Place in the Sun. Some of it's on YouTube, but hopefully somebody out there has the DVD, because it's great footage. And the rally that year, I think, was somewhere in the region of, I don't know, it was 30 or 35 stages. And I think I had a quick look the other day, that the first leg of the rally was substantially longer than the whole rally this year in terms of stage mileage. And the winning time was over 12 and a half hours. So
wow.
It says there's an interview with Fabrizio Pons halfway through it, and I think it's only like just starting the second leg, and she says we are all really tired. And
wow,
yeah.
As tenuous links go, I never thought a Channel 4 property program would ever be used as a link in our program.
Well,
there you go.
You can never guess where it's going to go. Any other business?
No, absolutely. Absolutely, Oscar the dog. Now, my only other business is I tweeted the video and I watched the video numerous times, and it just makes me smile, and I love him to bits. And it's Francois Delacour's interview on Corsica, which is just brilliant. There is no shadow of a doubt in that man's mind. If you've not seen it, folks, I've tweeted it outright. You know where we are on Twitter now, obviously. It's Absolute _ Rally. I tweeted out a video of Francois Delacour, and it's Francois Delacour effectively saying, if you gave me one of those cars over there, I'd be top five. And there is no wry smile. There is no kind of wink or anything like that. He is adamant, Jack, that he would be top five.
Yeah, it's a brilliant video, isn't it? And it's so typical of Francois, that video. It's, you know, he's, you know, unwavering belief in himself that he is one of the best rally drivers out there. And, you know, I think you'd struggle to argue with him maybe back in the 90s, but it's, you know, being top five in the WRC now might be a bit of a push for the man, but
I still wouldn't argue with him. I still wouldn't have that conversation.
Exactly what I was getting to. Even if you do think he was better back in the 1990s before he crashed his friend's Ferrari F40, then, you know, he's a very scary man in a way, isn't he? And
did you see, funnily enough, talking about Delacour interviews, the one, it was a few years back in Romania, but it was shared again on Twitter the other day, the interview about the carrot.
No, I've not seen that one.
All right. Well, we'll share that on the Absolute Rally Twitter account as well, because Francois Delacour has just won the rally, and there's a local Romanian TV crew, and they want to interview him about winning the Rally of Romania, and he talks about a carrot, and has a carrot in his hand.
Of course he does. Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he? It's just we talked about characters before. And bless him. I think he's worth his weight in gold. I think we should give him a WRC car. I really do. I think we should do some crowdfunding I think for Corsica next year or something. I don't know. But just to have him in a WRC car, I think it would be phenomenal. But that was one of my only other businesses. I am going to cheat because I've got three any other businesses. And one is tipping my hat accordingly to a co-driver. We spoke about the driver before on Corsica. It was it's Scott Martin, who, of course, Craig Breen's co-driver, who Craig Breen, eyes on Stork, stage end, lost the intercom. And I watched some of the onboard with Scott doing some hand signals and everything else and giving the numbers of the corners. And it was phenomenal. I'm sure you've seen it, boys. But, you know, Craig said, I never want to go through that again. I'm sure I'm sure none of us would. But that's called thinking on your feet, I guess. But I suppose, Jack, there's nothing else you can really do is to try and make good of a really, really scary bad situation.
A couple of interesting things about that. I think the first one being that I don't think that's happened to Scott before is something he was saying after the event. It's never, intercom's never gone off at any level of rallying for him, so it was completely new for him. And the other part being just how good Craig Breen was in that stage. To be able to, he'd watch the video in the morning, and Craig, anyone who knows Craig knows how hard he works on the video and buries his head in the notes and the video trying to remember everything he can. But he said there was two or three corners he got caught out on where he couldn't remember, but the rest of it he remembered vividly. And that for me is what sets these guys apart from well, definitely from me, but the likes of you sort of national rally drivers or that kind of level, because to be able to remember a stage in Corsica, especially the length and the amount of corners that these stages have got, and just to plough a stage in like that and only lose sort of, I think it was 18 seconds he lost on the stage, and that
I think it was something like
and Danny, and Danny Sordo was one position ahead and had lost 15, and OJ had lost 14 or something, so he'd really been pretty much on the pace, just dropped a little bit. So that, for me, that was just a phenomenal performance from both of them, really.
Right, I've experienced it kind of completely different level. Grant, have you ever been in that position with no intercom?
Yeah, I have, but a long time ago. But funnily enough, it's one thing I always make sure I do now is carry two intercoms in the car, because I always think for the price of an intercom, it can cost you a rally. But I actually think it was a helmet problem, wasn't it, in their situation?
It was. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, scary boo. But that he was. I just felt we needed to mention him. And one last mention, completely unrelated to Corsica and everything else that was going on last weekend. But Calvin Beattie, I just wanted to a bit of a mention. We spoke about the Adam Cup, which is going on over in Germany, which I think is such a fantastic one mate championship. Ryan and I, of course, have been wax lyrical over one mate championships, and of course, the winner of that has gone forward to be Chris Ingram. Teammate from last year into ERC this year, and Calvin on a podium, new co-driver Jack Morton, who of course done BRC and stuff over the last few years as well. But just wanted to mention those boys as well. Good luck, boys. Hopefully we will get you on the podcast soon. Boys, that's the end of our first episode.
Can I ask you a question first?
Of course,
you know the team that Calvin Beattie drives for, because it's probably one of my favourite teams in the whole world, just because of the name.
I don't know it. No.
It's Schmack Motorsport.
Schmack.
Which I think is just brilliant.
I really, really hope their spokesman is Sean Connery, because I think that'd be brilliant. I think that would be fantastic, by the way. I didn't know it was one of those arrive and drive deals where basically they were all run by one team. I'll be honest, I don't know too much about it, but all I know is that it seems to be a really, really good championship.
Yeah, there's a few different teams, and I think it's €3,500 for your entry, and that includes four people in the hospitality tent and the service park, and it includes all your rally entries, and that includes Rally Germany. So you get an entry to the national sort of event that runs on the back of Rally Germany and the rest of the championship as well, which I think is 7 or 8 rounds, and it's $3,500 to enter. It's a no brainer to go and do it, in my opinion. It's a phenomenal championship.
What the rental is on the cars, though? Because that's, I guess, where it comes back around again, if the rental highs.
I don't know the exact numbers, but I've spoke to a few people about it who are going over there, and it seems to be really, a really cost effective way to do it. So
absolutely. Oh, well, there you go. Hopefully we'll get the boys on. We'll have a chat with them and find out how it's going over there. As I say, that is the end of the first episode, folks. Just a couple of bits of housekeeping. Thank you all so much. I know I say this every time, but last season was our best ever season. And I don't know what's changed, whether people are spreading the love as we keep on pleading with you to do, but it was phenomenal. And we had some really, really nice things. I felt the two last episodes were way too long, but we couldn't cut them short in any way, shape or form. We're going to try and be a little bit more a little bit more aware of our timekeeping, I think, on some of these episodes for this season. But we had some nice things said about them. So thank you all so much for downloading them and telling friends and everything else. It wouldn't be the same without you. It'd just be me, Ryan and Jack on Skype, just shouting at one another. Always remember that. Jack, same time, same place next week.
Absolutely. It's been really nice to be back. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, I look forward to next week as well.
I know, I've missed you.
I've missed the pair of you. We've barely spoke over the past couple of weeks, and it's been quite unusual, actually. I've missed it. So.
We've been building up to it, though. I'll be honest with you, Jack. When you first answered the phone to me today, I thought, oh, Jack sounds a bit mardy. This could be a bit tricky, this one.
Well, you know, I am basically a mardy adolescent teenager, so that's generally how my mood goes.
Absolutely. Ryan Champion, you're about to go and give some kind of talk or lecture or something. I don't know. You know, you could be teaching James Bond how to do things. I really don't know. Can we tell people what you're about to do?
I'm about to do a presentation at an evening event on a new product launch, a new car at the Great Yorkshire Showground, which was stage one of the 1991 RAC Rally.
That's been a bit of a theme recently, hasn't it? Yeah. I've noticed, by the way, that you've been pulling these ones out.
I walked out the front door the other day and I thought, I wonder where the RAC went. And then I dragged the footage off YouTube, and sure enough, it was outside the front door of the exhibition centre. So.
Do you know what? Yeah, I actually genuinely feel sorry for your missus sometimes. I really do. I really do. Right, are you around? Obviously, you're on baby watch, aren't you?
Yeah, that's, so I'm still grounded. Still grounded. Not allowed out of the county now.
Really? Okay, you've got like an electronic tag or something.
Fortunately, it's a big county, but, you know.
So you're with us again next week anyway, which is really, really important. We've got some other bits and pieces coming up next week. I'm not going to say anything because one guest we were meant to have this week unfortunately couldn't be with us, and I didn't announce it. So as far as you're concerned, you got everything you were expecting in the podcast this week. But little do you know, until you got to this bit, you really didn't. But folks, thank you for the download. We will be back same time, same place next week. Absolute_rally on Twitter, absoluterally.co.uk, of course, and patreon.com/absoluterally if you feel you can get involved.